This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, welcome back all in one show. How are you guys doing? We missed you, Dr. Hawk.
Yeah, it's our reunion tour.
All good.
Reunion tour in a pandemic where we can't actually, play any cities.
So. There you go.
Sorry. All right. Continue virtual life. Well,
Dr. Hawk, it sounds like you want to bring up some topics. You're welcome to do so.
Oh no, we can rant about things as they come up organically, or we can just save that for Hawk Blocked.
Yeah, that's good.
I'm always in a mood to rant about politics, though.
Yeah,
that's just my baseline state.
Fair enough. Well, we're definitely going to have some opportunity because a couple of our questions have to do with people in different lockdowns or vaccine passport, limbo. And so it's kind of the questions that come up from there. But how are you doing otherwise, Dr. Hawk? You're in Seattle still?
Yeah, I'm good. I am. It's very dark and rainy here. Yeah. That's okay. We have lots of little twinkle lights for the holidays. So that, makes up for it. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Sounds miserable.
can't go anywhere.
Yeah. Speaking of miserable, Dr. Lyle, how's your heated pool? Is it good?
It's no longer warm enough to go in, so we're shut down till May. But that's all right. It still looks good.
Is the chicken still wandering around there?
The chickens are gone. I got rid of the chickens.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so that's it. Some neighbor has a chicken now.
I'm waiting for the Instagram account devoted to the one indoor chicken. I really want that chicken to have its own Instagram account. And I think Sam is just a born star. Yeah. He would go viral immediately with little photos of him and that chicken.
Actually, yeah. That's really interesting. He is a star. He just doesn't know it.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
He just doesn't know it.
Yeah.
So yeah, this would find him a girlfriend.
Yes.
It would be financial security for the clan forever. It has to happen.
Jen, that is a remarkable concept because Sam is how would you describe his appearance, Jen?
Rasputin-esque.
Young
dashing Rasputin.
Yes.
Who are we talking about here?
Yeah, this is what would you call him?
your charge.
Oh, he's a human, or he's another chicken or a cat?
No, he's a human.
No,
he's a human. Oh, okay. Okay. Sorry, I was lost.
Credits short of his degree in ecology from Santa Cruz. That just says
this
it all. And he looks like he's three credits
on.
Short.
He does. He really looks the part. But he's handsome in his way.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, he is.
He's quite handsome. Yeah. He's got a very elusive, kind of charismatic, mysterious aura to him.
Yes.
Which contributes to the whole Rasputin vibe.
Yes.
He has, periodically a very long beard, which is why I give him the Rasputin name. But all of these things make him quite Instagram worthy. he's really like and he has this chicken that lives inside with him. And so the chicken is just absolute Instagram gold or some sort of social media. You got to monetize this whole thing because it's, sort of Sam's aw shucks affect combined with the hijinks of the chicken are just, this is why the internet exists.
Yep. All right. All right. I'll think about that.
I'm trying to find a segue, but I think I did. Yeah. So speaking of girlfriends, our first question.
Good.
That was nicely done.
Good.
Thank you. Thank you. Our first question. Dear doctors, the marriage of a lesbian friend of mine recently dissolved because my friend's wife decided that she wanted to pursue a polyamorous lifestyle. My friend wanted the relationship to be monogamous. How do you explain, in the context of evolutionary psychology, women who pursue polyamory? It seems like they are doing a good job of beating the instructions dealt them by their genes. Alternatively, is polyamory just the new politically correct way of cheating on your spouse and then potentially ending an unwanted relationship?
Well, you know, whatever you feel like, Jen. This is sort of like, you know, cleaning out the refrigerator. You can kind of start anywhere. You know, it doesn't really matter what shelf you start on.
I see this. This is, I think they're getting to something that is close to the truth with the second scenario here, that this is, you know, sort of a way of, if not getting out of the relationship, sort of, you know, laying the groundwork to get out of the relationship or to go get market testing in other venues. So I don't think that's always the case in polyamorous relationships, particularly women seeking or pushing for the polyamory. You could just have a very high degree of openness in that personality, which is probably always going to be part of the dynamic. I would say it's like necessary but not sufficient for somebody to be pursuing, for a female to be pushing for the polyamory. In a lesbian relationship, that's a really interesting situation. And my spidey sense would be that this woman was just not happy in the relationship and that this was pretext. And obviously I don't know that. I don't know these people. I don't know the specifics. I don't know their personalities, but I would say just anecdotally, and my intuition is that would be the case a lot of the time. And so that's, you know, you've got an open person who was sort of not feeling super thrilled and over rewarded in their relationship. And this was a nice little cultural trend and narrative to latch onto, which helped legitimize those feelings and give them space. And, oh, you don't want that, so I guess we're not right for each other. So that is going to be the case a lot of the time. I don't think there's a fancier, more kind of, you know, evolutionary analysis of that, of women so-called beating their genes in this way. I think this is just women maximizing their utility within a relationship, whatever that relationship looks like. And in this case, probably, you know, looking to find space in it, if not to get out of it entirely.
Yeah, I totally agree. At the end of the day, folks, all there is there's gene variation and there's situational variation. That's all there is. So Jen's talking about openness being the gene variation, and then the situational variation is how rewarded you feel. So those two things are like the bass and the treble things on your stereo. And so if they're both turned up pretty high, then it's going to get unstable. And if they're both turned very low, it's going to be very stable. So that's just all there is to it. There's no fancy serpentine adaptation there. And the person isn't beating their genes or going against any program or anything else. It's just openness, under reward, I'm out. You know what I mean? And that's what it looks like to me, probably is. And it was obviously because the person left the relationship. So
the person laid down an ultimatum. Yeah.
Right. Right. So there wasn't enough value in it to, you know, et cetera. So I think we got it figured out.
Yeah, and this could be just, you know, a case of somebody who really is wired for polyamory in the sense that they are very, very open.
Yeah.
And they are kind of restless and not suited for monogamy. And this doesn't have to be a case of being really unhappy or not being sufficiently rewarded. But it very often will be the case that those two things independently reach some sort of threshold. You have to be some degree of openness and you have to be some degree of unhappy. So if you have a very open person, person, they could be pretty happy in the relationship, but they just, it's not enough. You know, it's they want to have some degree of openness, whether it's full-fledged polyamory or, people navigate this terrain in so many different ways according to the rules of every given relationship. So it's not necessarily the case that somebody who wants an open dynamic in their relationship is unhappy, but it is going to be the case more often than not that that's true.
Yeah. Wonderful.
All wonderful. Good. All right, yeah. Nathan.
What do you think there's any, Dr. Lau, you've been in practice for a long time, mm-hmm. Several decades, and now that it's a little
Thanks.
Bit more.
Go ahead.
You're wise.
So
that's what I was trying
many
to say.
Decades.
You're
decades
so wise.
Decades.
Decades and decades and practically centuries at this point.
That's great. Now, what's your question?
With so much wisdom over this this long amount of time, do you think that I guess what am I trying to say? That I guess it's a little bit more accepted now than it may have been in the beginning of your practice. Mm. So would you expect the higher open people who are actually like really kind of built for polyamory to be hiding it less nowadays than they were maybe 20 years ago?
I'm sure that would be true. So, but I think that it's actually an interesting question that comes up about all my years and years and years of experience. Decades, sorry about that. I have never seen a case or heard a case in the thousands of people that I've talked to. I happen to have never heard of a woman in a relationship that wanted it to be polyamorous, that was wanted to be polyamorous, but was committed and into her relationship. Not one. Okay. So that isn't to say that they don't exist. I'm sure they do exist, but I believe it's probably on the order of 1 in 1,000. So it's the outliers that Jen's going to be talking about there. I'm sure they're out there. I have no doubt. Maybe I'll get an email from one of them. Okay.
Yeah.
But I, quite frankly, as a clinician with more than 30 years of clinical experience and have talked to, you know, several thousand women about their relationships in my career, I have not had one. Okay. So I've had men, obviously, which would make a lot of sense, just from a straight evolutionary point of view, but women, no. So there you go.
Well, I've had women who believed that the polyamory would make the relationship satisfying, right? So they brought this to their partner thinking, mm-hmm. if only I can, you know, scratch this itch in this way and I can, maybe I'm bisexual and I'm in a heterosexual relationship and I need to be dating some women, or maybe I just need a little more variety, or maybe mm-hmm. whatever it is, then you qualify totally except for that little thing. And so mm-hmm. I just need this little thing. So I have seen that. Mm-hmm. I have seen that, you know, being sort of promoted and pursued by the female in the relationship. Mm-hmm. So this is not to say that, you know, it's being that you're completely unhappy, but that it's there is something missing when women are seeking this. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All good.
Thank you. Thank you. Nathan. All right. Okay. So speaking of dating, we've got another question, but now Dr. Hawk, get ready. You might have to go on a political rant here in just a second.
Uh-oh.
Dear doctors, my question pertains to dating during COVID. I'm a female in my early 20s from Canada. Currently, with a vaccine mandate, I can't sit inside a restaurant or even join an outdoors sports group. This makes meeting people and dating rather impossible. I'm well aware of the issues with dating apps, but should I try my luck just to get out into the market? If so, should I display my vaccine status? My date will find out pretty soon when I say I can only go on a hiking date, or should I continue to avoid this mess and just focus on improving other areas of my life? It's quite depressing, and I'm not sure how long it will last, but maybe I just need to hunker down. I guess I could always play Russian roulette with the vaccine, too. Anyways, I appreciate any advice. I would move to the U.S. Harry Brown style if I could, but currently I'm trapped in my country.
Oh man, trapped.
Doug is amused.
Trapped in what was what 2 years ago was deemed the freest country in the world by the, some agency.
Formerly free state of Canada. Yeah. I've talked to quite a few Canadians who are in the same situation. So we need to get you guys together. So this is, I would say, if nothing else, you know, there's sort of a, we don't manage it or organize it, but there are kind of fans of the podcast who have set up a Discord server. So, you know, get on there and start, you know, start a conversation, say you're looking to meet people. That's one way to do it. I've told other people that you could look for, you know, fish where the fish are is always where we go with this kind of question. And so looking in communities that are already sharing your sentiments and your political views. So whether those are designated online communities or I know some of the dating apps do have a designation for vaccine status right there in the bio. I don't know if that's happening in Canada, but I was hearing about that happening in some regional markets. I would say in general, I mean, this is kind of, it's up there with anything else that you're going to have to disclose at some point in a relationship. And there's some sort of, there's some mathematical equation to figure out exactly when the best time to disclose these things are based on how deal breaking they are. But I think in most cases, you know, if you find a good candidate on the apps who it doesn't come up in the initial conversation, it's worth, you know, going for a walk in the park. Do they, if they still let you do that there? I'm amazed that you can't join like a sporting group. That's
yeah.
Like
imagine
a,
that an outdoor sporting group. She says she's not
yeah,
even allowed to do that.
I'm surprised that that's banned for unvaxxed. I know some of them are requiring masking, but that's impressive. But I can't imagine that you would be prevented from bundling up and walking around a lake in your town or just going on some sort of outdoor walk. And then in the course of that conversation, you'll discover two things, whether that candidate is worth progressing as a romantic prospect. And if so, then yeah, I mean, it's going to come up. COVID is going to come up in conversation. It'd be impossible for it not to. So I think this is the sort of thing you disclose on the earlier side before you sink a lot of time and energy into it. But I don't necessarily think you need to lead with it on your profile apart from fishing where the fish are. So if you're already in a group where you know it's not going to be an issue, that's one thing. If you're fishing for normies on Tinder and you get somebody who's looks really promising, then you just play it by ear. And, you know, the worst case scenario is that you went for a walk and you got some tea and it's too much for the other person to deal with, and so be it.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how I would generally approach that. But totally, I mean, I've talked to multiple people in Canada. I don't know where you are, but I, you know, from sea to sea in Canada, who are experiencing this and feeling really isolated and looking for community, whether it's romantic or friendship. And so use us, you know, use the Discord server, use the Facebook page. Definitely people who are listening to us are birds of a feather to some degree.
Yeah, you're kind of in a rough spot in the winter in Canada.
It's
going to be obviously a lot easier. You're in some ways in a tight spot for a few months before you can meet people in outdoor situations that are going to be comfortable. So, yeah, I don't know. You could also, I was thinking about this, put myself in those circumstances. In my little dating profile at this point, I probably put something like, and by the way, I'm not vaxxed quite yet. Okay. Or in other words, I'm not vaxxed just yet. In other words, if we made a comment like that, it's not argumentative. Okay. So it's not like, well, I'm not vaxxed. Okay. If we put a little equivocating phrase in there, it's friendlier and it, and then if it turns out that the people on the other side are all hostile and weird, twisted, it's like, well, then hell with them. But they are not all going to be that way. And so that's another angle. So I'm hearing Jen's strategy. In other words, you want to, i.e. disclose early, et cetera, but you could also you could disclose completely right off the bat with making sure that we signal that we're not sitting on any, you know, partisan hostility around it. And I think you could file off that pretty well by the way that you would, in other words, it could be a throwaway comment at the end. Oh, and by the way, I haven't got my vax yet, like that. That's pretty friendly, and if it's taken wrong, my attitude is, oh well, good riddance. It would be my attitude.
So anyway, it definitely forces the issue to predate conversation, where if it is going to be an issue, other person is going to be like, well, I'm not comfortable going out with you until you're vaxxed. You know, that will come up. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of doing the work that I'm describing with the first date preemptively. Sure. So it really just depends on your conflict tolerance and how interested you are in getting into this. It's kind of similar to the vegan issue. We get a lot of people who it's like, oh well, yeah, when do I tell the guy that I actually have this really limited diet and I don't eat like normal people and I do this SOS free thing? And so usually the recommendation there is similar to what you're saying. It's kind of this, oh, you know, just FYI, I have some dietary limitations, no big deal. Like I'm sure whatever restaurant we pick, I can find something. Like, i.e., I have some, I'm a little unusual, so you've been forewarned, but it's not anything that you need to worry about or make your problem. And then, you know, that will weed out people early on who are like, oh, well, that's I had one guy who said something like, oh, don't worry, I'll eat enough chicken for both of us or something. I'm like, okay. Yeah. Like a rule out. So yeah, that's the kind of thing that you're just it's case by case. But I would hate for you to miss out on a possibly really worthwhile connection by scaring them off too early, before you go on the walk and you both are really googly eyed toward each other and then it comes up and then the guy's got sort of a little more context for his confusing feelings.
That's amazing. So Dr. Lyle, thank you. So okay, sure. So I got to change my profile because right now it says
no way in hell am I vaxxed. That's what it says.
I've not gotten
the
clot shot. No clot shot for me.
But that's another strategy, and that's totally fair. So like
yours is more reasonable, Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle. Yeah. It's way more reasonable. I didn't even realize it.
On a dating profile, you know, I don't eat dead animals or the secretions of dead animals. And so, you know, it's like, okay, well, I know what I'm dealing with. Like, you're narrowing the field, but you're preventing any wasted time. So
just imagine at least
on that issue.
Imagine what Alan Goldhammer's dating profile would look like if he was just completely, you know, unplugged. Just put it all out there.
Horrifying.
So it brings me another question, like a little follow-up, which is, I remember a few shows, many, many shows ago, years and years ago, decades. No, I think we were talking about, 60th percentile attractiveness, 80th percentile attractiveness, the numbers that, the percentile attractiveness.
Yeah.
And the insinuation was that, like, if someone has kids, for example, if they have something that brings their value down a little bit, that may bring down a point potentially.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is when you are at the very ends of the bell curves as far as, or maybe not the bell curves, but very ends of societal norms, what would you estimate that brings your value down?
Oh, you mean for something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, I would say that it doesn't bring your value down at all. It just narrows your market.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's what that's like. It's like a woman who's 6 feet tall. It doesn't bring her value down. It just narrows her market. Mm-hmm. You know, it just means that, you know, everybody 5'10" is ruling themselves out. So that's how that looks. Mm. Yeah, it's not all these kinds of things. I don't see most of these things as dings. And actually, that includes, that was that joke about woman has children. Larry's attitude is it's 2 points off for the first one, and then it's a point off for everyone.
Oh, Jesus. This is not a show that I was on. Must have been in the decades before I joined.
Yes.
Yeah. But the truth is that that's not really true. In other words, mm-hmm. it's all context dependent, and it absolutely narrows market is what that does. Okay. And so that's how to look at that. So in Nathan in Los Angeles, you know, is in a position where you can be as disagreeable and market narrow as you want because there's the market is massive. You know, but if you're in Canada and you can't even meet at a coffee shop because you're not vaxxed, well, you got a much narrower market. So such is life. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Los Angeles is getting close to that too. Unfortunately.
Might be time to escape soon. All right. Let's go on. Let's get into trouble.
All right. Very good. So our next question. Dear doctors, I've been in a magic 10% relationship for almost 2 years. He treats me like a princess, but what robs me of peace of mind is that he has a sister my age. He is 30. I am 26. And his sister is a single mother. And she often asks him for help, money, babysitting. At some point, she even asked him to live with her. He refused, but he felt guilty afterwards. Looking at her life decisions, it's easy to predict that she will need him consistently in the future. Even when she was in a relationship, she was asking my partner for money. She relies on him as she has a bad relationship with their parents. And as I mentioned, apart from that, it is a magic 10% and a genuine connection. I'm not interested in anyone else. Is me sharing my man with his sister a sufficient reason to break up? I can see how it is the evolutionary wiring warning against sharing partners' commitment and resources. I'm not happy in this relationship, but if it wasn't for his sister needing him this much, I would be. He says I am his priority, but his sister is more in need. She tried to commit suicide years ago, and he is worried it will repeat. It feels feels bad both to be in this relationship as well as to potentially end this relationship. It makes me feel guilty as well because there's not much of my partner's fault. Is there anything that can be done?
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. Okay, so where I start with this is we look at what the conflict is, and the conflict is sitting. The fundamental conflict is in this the boyfriend's brain about his resource. He's got resource allocation conflict, and so then the secondary conflict of that winds up impacting his relationship with our girl here, and so that puts her in conflict as she watches this conflict. So the and the reason why, in other words, normally speaking, it would be the case that he would not be in this conflict because the girlfriend in the primary relationship, it was sufficiently valuable. There wouldn't be any serious resource allocation conflicts. In other words, she would not only be priority, but her squawking would dominate his calculus. So it's interesting that we learned in this odyssey here about this helpless, essentially resourceless sister who has a child. So we've got effectively, he's got half a child there sitting underneath her wing. In other words, because that's a niece or a nephew. And also that she's potentially theoretically suicidal. So there's potentially catastrophic loss and consequences if somehow she goes off the rails. Now, so what's probably happening just on the face of it, is this is a conscientious guy who is miscalibrating he's not analyzing his resource allocation very effectively. So, and he's agreeable enough and conscientious enough that he's in trouble. I could be wrong. Maybe our girl who's written the note is just a hypersensitive, you know, selfish individual who, when he diverts 5% of his variable excess resource time and energy, it freaks her out. But it doesn't sound like that. It sounds like it's enough and recurrent enough and essentially urgent enough that it's a really serious annoyance. And it's doing exactly what she says. It's signaling trouble in terms of just long-term protection and provision. So I would say that what he needs is he needs some help. So he could really use an hour with Jen Hawk. Not me. I don't want to. I'm just kidding. Either one of us or somebody else. In other words, one of the two of us would be a very good place to go to get some assistance with this. He needs to have a third party who is not invested in anything other than his best interest to walk through his mind and see whether or not there's evidence of distortions in how it is that he's analyzing the problem. And if it looks like there's evidence of distortions, then the therapeutic move is to run experiments that can help us get more information to find out what transpires on the other end of those experiments. Okay. So yeah, I can see this whole thing, and it would be indeed a shame if this situation, if the needy sister essentially by virtue of his conscientiousness and agreeableness and her neediness, i.e. disagreeable and instability and lack of conscientiousness, winds up sinking a really potentially outstanding relationship. That is a very, very expensive price for those two nervous systems to pay as a result of that sister's life circumstances. So that decision needs to be analyzed very intelligently, as opposed to what's going on now, which is just impressionistically, as he sort of chases one little crisis after the next and throws some time and energy and money at it, and then gets over until she hits another bump in the road. So that's what I think, and so I don't know what would come out of it, but I do know that from the standpoint of the person who's asking us the question, the answer isn't in the decision making that you would be doing. The mistake that's taking place isn't inside your head. The mistake that is potentially in the middle of this mess is inside of his head. So it's his head that needs more information, and that's where we would put our lever to move this little world.
Yeah, she might be making a mistake if he's not committing as much resources and time and mm-hmm. diversion of all of this as she anticipates in the future. So
right.
getting her, like mm-hmm. the other thing that would be beneficial for the person who is asking this question is to really get very crystal clear about how much money is being diverted, how much it's taking from her, how often he's saying no relative to, because she's signaling here in the question that he has, you know, denied her in the past. He just feels bad about it. So mm-hmm. I read into this question a lot of apprehension about how things are going to go in the future. And, you know, there's a lot of things you can't know about how things are going to go in the future based mm-hmm. on how things are going now. And so if it is the case that he's, you know, if you total it up and he's giving $1,000 a year to her and, you know, X number hours of time, it might be calming to your nervous system, the person who's asking this question, mm-hmm. to actually get really clear about that. And, oh, it's not as much as I thought, and I can live with this, and mm-hmm. this is reasonable. The other big moving piece that is impossible to predict is that she's single. She's 26. Mm-hmm. And she, I would presume, is, you know, searching for someone to date. And if she were to find somebody who occupies that position in her world, and she, you know, asks him for this type of support and redirects all of that energy into that relationship, then that would take a lot of stress off of your relationship. And so kind of having a better idea of what that looks like, what her prospects look like, how interested she is, that's an important piece to understand too.
Yeah.
All become her wing
context
woman.
All over this. Yeah. It's also not a bad idea for the listener to talk to us as well, to one of us, because for the very same reasons, and that what's causing the cognitive dissonance is a lack of precision over the estimation of the parameters.
Yeah.
So that's
just a lot of apprehension. Yeah.
That's right. And so sometimes getting a computer check from people who are some much older and wiser, much
decades
older and wiser, like multiples. But by doing that, that can be super useful. So I can think of, there's been at least, 500 times in my career where the person was sort of swirling around and kind of upset and not sure how upset they should be about some exchange and price process in their situation. And I said, hey, no, they're being totally reasonable. And it's a lot of times they had been data fishing in their coalition, and their coalition had been saying, oh no, the people on the other side of that thing are being very unreasonable. You should be treated so much better. And when they bring it to me, I'm like, no, actually, that's completely reasonable. Oh, well, now they don't feel so essentially insulted, or they're not as anxious about that they're not that valuable, because what's actually taking place from a third party's view is actually reasonable. So that's why, I'm glad Jen brought up the other side of that. So there's this is all about trying to get a feel for, what the truth is. How much does he value you? How chronic is the long-term situation? And, what is he responding to in terms of why are the resources going the way they are, and how urgent it is, and how chronic it's going to be, and what does that mean, et cetera. These are all parametric estimation problems, and our feelings are derivatives of the estimates of those parameters. And a lot of times they are worst case scenario estimates. So go ahead, Jen.
No, especially to go back to your earlier point, if your coalition, your friend network is encouraging those worst case scenario estimates. So, you're bringing this problem to your immediate coalition. They're like, oh my God, you're so right. This is going to be a disaster down the road. And, this is totally, it means he doesn't care about you enough. And you're getting this kind of feedback from immediate coalition, which is doubling down on the distortion that might exist there.
Yeah. Yeah, great, really good question. And, we're here to not only just in general frame this thing as a process of trying to get, parameter estimates as you can, but also that's also what we do is we try to help people figure out what they can do, what little experiments they can run in order to get information that feels solid, and therefore that way your nervous system feels appropriately relative to the variables that you're facing. And because I could see this going multiple ways, very completely opposite directions. If I heard one story at the end of it, I'd be like, well, God, this guy's just way too agreeable, so he's effectively in a codependent tar pit, and it's going to be a nightmare. Okay, I could say that, or I could say, no, this is a stand-up guy who is just being overly responsible, needs a little bit of guidance about what limits he can set with his sister, and otherwise, this is great. This guy is, he's a superstar. So there's, that's a large variance there, and no wonder could be a puzzling problem.
Wonderful. Well, right. It's a good time to bring up that if listeners want to book consults, I can't imagine they don't know where to go, but I'm going to tell them anyway, which is esteemdynamics.com. And just a little spoiler alert, I just read one of the chapters that you guys released out into the wild of the Living Wisdom Library, which was amazing. So I'm addicted, and I can't wait for more.
All right.
Is the one chapter of the book, the book that you guys are both writing. So again, esteemdynamics.com.
Yes, that's on our It's on our website for members.
Yes,
and members I've had a few only. People email me and say that they've heard us mention this and they can't find it on the website. If you're logged in the members section, it's under the resources. There's sort of a resources tab, but you have to be logged in because it's in the members library. So it's called The Mysterious Visitor.
Yes, yep. And I don't know about anybody else, but I read that chapter and heard Dr. Lyle's voice, you know, just...
All right.
Our next question. Dear doctors, does having a surrogate mother versus having a natural birth drive a subconscious rift between husband and wife because certain neural networks were not tripped in the female brain? And if that's true, is there any solution, treatment, maybe hormones or something that can trip these circuits so that the natural attachments are made, but without putting that female through that pain and causing them to go through the cycle, physiological changes?
Well, what the person is referring to, I'm going to assume that this is the woman's eggs are put into a surrogate, and so it's the couple's natural child. Both of them are biological.
Yeah, I think we have to assume that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's a whole different question. Yeah.
Of course.
Non-genetic relationship to the kid.
Right. So the question would be, it is known that when women go through, when animals go through childbirth, if you will block the pain of childbirth, you can cause some animals to not be attached to their children, their offspring. And so so now the question would be, if they're your children, but you didn't go through that, you know, are you going to be missing a bit of the innate attachment that would take place from doing that? I would have to say that is in an entirely empirical question.
Totally. And we have no idea.
We have no idea. And I don't believe that there is any such mechanism. In humans. I mean, it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I see human beings are extraordinarily attached to their children. And so if you're, now, maybe it's possible that, you know, the female literally somehow, so it's actually talking about this resentment between husband and wife. I'm not sure about exactly what she's asking, but I'm assuming that the root of this is the idea that if I'm not 100% sure that these are my kids, do I feel like I'm raising some other woman's kids? Is that how you interpret this, Jen?
Yeah, or that there was some kind of going back to the animal studies that you're talking about. I didn't know that. I hadn't heard that before. But maybe that there's some sort of bonding process that they missed out on going through this difficult process together. So he wasn't there holding her hand while she was having the child, and therefore they didn't have this force that brought them together. They missed out on that. So I think she's the suggesting that there might be some sort of hormonal solution to that. That, you know, there's some kind of way that you could flood the system artificially to create that feeling of bondedness that they're otherwise missing out on. I think that's unlikely, but again, we don't know. I don't think that this has ever been looked at in any sort of rigorous way.
Yeah, no, there wouldn't be some bizarre bonding process of the male being there for the childbirth. The bonding process would be between the female and her children.
Of course, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And that, I don't think that in all of the epidurals that have been given to females in the last 50 years, you know, I don't think that there's any indication that that there's any less attachment to their children. So,
or to their spouse.
Yeah, or to their spouse.
Yeah.
Right. So,
and for most of human history, well, I don't know. Yes, for most of modern human history, men are not allowed in the delivery room, right? So they're outside smoking their cigars. And this is a process that the women are dealing with. And I think that I obviously there are exceptions in hunter-gatherer societies, but certainly for many, many, many decades of human history.
Yeah.
And even centuries. This is a women's midwifing. This is women's business. Men don't have anything to do with the childbirthing process. So they're banned from the whole domain. So yeah, the idea that that something would be lacking in the relationship with your spouse because he was not there as part of the process doesn't sit quite right with me. But it hasn't been tested.
Yeah. Whatever. If there is anything to this question, it's going to be a very small effect size.
Yeah.
So that's how we would look at that. So more likely if this questioner is talking about their own life, then probably what there is there's just some low grade conflict between the husband and wife.
Yeah.
Such as life.
And a new baby causing a lot of stress.
Oh my God. You know, like, unbelievable.
I mean, totally.
Yeah. Phil Cowan and his wife at Berkeley 50 years ago established that first year of, you know, the first year or two of raising children is the most conflicted time between mates. And it's the most likely time for them to break up.
Yeah.
You know, so such as welcome to reality.
Yeah, you're both seeing new facets of each other's personality that was not previously visible to you. You're discovering things about this person that you may not like very much. And you're plugging that into your whole matrix of expectations for the future and not liking the CB in new ways that you didn't before. So that's going to be going on in any kind of new parenting situation. And so you're looking around for some good reason to explain that, and you can't blame postpartum. And so you sort of are looking at this, well, this was an unusual childbirth process. And so maybe we're missing something. Maybe there's a wedge driven here because of this, but the wedge is the child itself.
Yeah.
and sort of the new context that it has cast on your relationship, most likely.
Yeah. Hmm. You gave birth to a little communist government. It's just going to take all the resources. You're formerly free people trading and having a great exchange, and then you just got a massive tax imposed on you, and you're both looking at each other like, well, we're not going to get it out of that thing, so... I'm short.
I saw this wonderful meme of side by side dogs with like little tilted cocked heads, and in the first one, it's like this, you know, looks like Mo has a don't tread on me flag, and was waving an American flag, and the caption says my dog when he's eating, and then the next frame is there's a communist flag, and there's a Che Guevara hat, there's like a Marx t-shirt, my dog when I'm eating.
That's it. I love it. That's beautiful. That's just great, Jen.
It's totally perfect. So this is what has been introduced into your family unit is intense redistribution of resources.
Yes.
So I guess the lesson is to get over rewarded as a buffer for all the things you might find out about the person.
Yeah,
sure.
You're going to find
that's
a lot
of the lessons.
Yeah, you're instantly going to put. I mean, that's where you find out in relationships on all kinds of ways where relationships get stressed, is you find out, you know, sort of how valuable you are, and you also find out in your own reactions to resource constriction how valuable they are, and so to you, in other words, so. Stress is a great detective for finding out what we how valuable these relationships really are, and so no surprise that when we put a relationship under tremendous stress like a young child, that we're going to find a lot of ripples in that lake. You know what I mean? And that's situation normal.
Disagreements about you know, how to raise the kid, how to discipline the kid, sleep deprivation, all these components are totally. I always recommend that new relationships, you know, test themselves with a road trip. this is like a road trip on steroids. I mean, you're really you're watching people under great stress and totally relocating yourself in the space around them to figure out where you fit in.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Wonderful. Well, let's do, you guys ready for, we want to do one more question. It's about raising a child.
Yeah. We'll do a quick one. Why not?
Okay.
Let it rip.
Dear doctors, see what it is. My husband and I are planning to start trying to get pregnant in 2 years. As an HCNC, I've been diligently studying and preparing for all the aspects of pregnancy, birth, postpartum, and child rearing. But I've now learned about the harsh realities of being a new parent and the incredible lack of sleep involved. Breastfeeding alone is needed every 2 to 4 hours around the clock for many months. Dr. Lyle has previously discussed the importance of sleep, and so my question is, if sleep is so vital, why would nature design such intense sleep deprivation for mothers, even stay-at-home moms, when raising young children? It seems so counterintuitive.
Well, nature didn't have us in modern suburban America. You know, this is not how it is. So, you know, the famous phrase from Africa is that it takes a village to raise a child. So there's all kinds of help around and all kinds of distribution of labor with respect to these things. And so it would be interesting to know from some anthropologist's view, if we were to go into these villages and find out whether the mothers were particularly sleep deprived, my guess is that they're not. My guess is that they get to dump those kids to their kid sister, you know what I mean? Who's wanting to pretend to be a mom.
Yeah, the many sisters and the cousins.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Everybody. So,
and every woman in the village is lactating, you know, because everybody's like their whole life is having kids. And so they're just swapping these kids around. And it's not like the baby is completely dependent on any one female for nourishment. And so, I think this really gets chalked up to certainly the family and the women in that family playing a much larger role in raising those babies.
Yeah. Yep, I think that's the end of the mystery. Good question.
Wow. That's
all right.
I love it. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, thank you so much. We had some fun, and we went back down memory lane of how many years we've been doing the podcast. No offense intended.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about my cats now with little hats, with little – now I can't –
No, it's so funny. It was so perfect. Just like in Melly in particular. Yeah. Melly just swaps out her hat.
Yes. Oh my God, it's priceless. Little Che Guevara hat.
Barrel That's of a gun. Totally got her little Che Guevara hat on.
I'm going to go down right now and I'm going to feed those two cats.
To each priceless. According to ability, to each according to my need. My need for kibble.
That's it. That says it all.
Yeah.
All right.
All right, Nathan.
Well, for the listeners trapped in their very respective countries, we wish you the best. We will keep answering your questions, and we'll look forward to speaking.
As long as it's allowed.
As long as it's allowed. Yeah. Yeah, I know. I wonder when they'll cancel Beat Your Genes in different countries. So
who knows?
Well, hope not.
Right. Yeah, we're small potatoes. We fly under the radar.
Yeah.
You got it. When they get to us, it'll be so obvious that, you know, you've
it'll
lost everything
late.
Else.
It'll be too late for everybody. Exactly.
All right, everybody.
Pretty true.
All right, have a good night, everybody.
Gotcha. We'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening. Bye. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.